Okay, Bob Marks and Bill Pierce and I drove cross-country nonstop, and I hadn't seen, I didn't see them again until one day one of my peers from Arts Center School actually graduated a semester before me. His name is Stan Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R, and he's a studio head at design staff yet. But his mother,
what studio is it?
He's in the advanced studio. I forget what the number of that studio is, but he at one time was head of Buick Studio, production studio. Very good career. He's from Connecticut, and his mother said, "Stanley, you ought to go downtown Detroit to meet Eleanor Petruska, who's from Connecticut too. She's a fine Polish descent lady." So Stan and I, you know, we shared a room together. We said, okay, what do we do? Tonight, we're going to go out and eat anyway. Let's go down and see this friend of my family, you know. So we went down there, and my guy walked in the door, and here's Bill Pierce, who had his own design company, Group Productions. And they were doing animated TV commercials, and Bob Mox was working for him. I hadn't seen him in about... the Army had gone by and graduation, so I think it was about 3 or 4 years, but he had a going company. A company within a company was run by Ellie and her girlfriend, Design House.
What had been her background?
She's a graduate of Pratt in advertising design, so she was running her own company. And we came in and introduced ourselves and had some common ground, you're Connecticut, et cetera. And instead of Stan and her taking a liking to each other, I guess they liked each other, but it was a little more than that with Ellie and I, and eventually that's how we got introduced, we were married. She still does a lot of sculpture and painting, and the house is just full of jewelry and painting and all kinds of things.
You were very happy, don't
you? Oh, yeah.
I want to throw a small curve here. I have seen that article. Mike Lamb gave it to me.
Oh.
And I want to ask you one question.
Yeah.
What happened to that gorgeous petite Italian girl that you're pictured with? Chieri, was it?
Vicky Chie. Chie,
yeah.
Yeah, she is, she's still... Yeah. She's still happily married down someplace in California, and somebody had seen her recently, and everything is fine, I guess, you know.
Life. Yeah. You haven't seen it since?
No, I haven't. Uh-uh. Yeah.
Well, so you're happily married, and you're well ensconced in the, you're going up the ladder, so to speak, in the design hierarchy. What is your next assignment?
Well, the biggest move that happened was when, in the 60s, you know, there was an awful lot of proliferation in car model lines. The Corvette became a real vehicle in pretty big numbers, 20, 30,000. Mm-hmm. Chevelles, Chevy 2s, Camaros came on, and show cars, and there was a great proliferation of design in the industry. At that time, the Chevy 1 studio had to be broken into several studios, so they
so they
made Chevy 2 Studio, and in 1963 they appointed me as studio chief for that studio.
It was
exciting. I'd been there 53, I guess I'd been there 10 years. We were in charge of production versions of the, as I said earlier, the Corvette, the Camaro, the Chevy 2, and the Corvair. And show cars. We slipped in a few show cars. Eventually, and I don't know what year later, the workload became so heavy that we then had to break off into Chevy 1, 2, and 3. And I was in charge of the Chevy 3 studio, which then did the Corvette and the Camaro and show cars.
What year was this?
I can't remember which year that break was. I would say 63 was the first assignment I had. Then it must have been about 4 years later, 67, something like that. And we moved different areas in the building, too.
Mm-hmm. I suppose this point would be helpful to, and perhaps you might want to record this section separately. Could you begin with your first impressions of the Corvette as you came to, before you came to Miller, perhaps, and then give us a sort of a capsule history of its development, who was responsible, and then pick it up where you joined it in the late 60s. Does that, would that be done at this point?
We'll try.
Or would you prefer to do it as a separate entity?
No, no, we could.
Would it fit in the continuity?
Yeah, yeah, I think it would.
Okay.
The exciting thing about being chief for the Corvette Camaro studio in 1963, first of all, it was a fresh studio. You're starting with a new name and whole new responsibilities, and you're getting into a job that had a certain amount of heritage about it with a Corvette. Corvette started in 53, and basically it had a truck chassis and truck wheels, and it was a sports car, two-passenger sports car with a limited amount of technology.
Whose inspiration was it?
God, it was Ed Coles, I suppose. Ed Coles and Harley Earls and a lot of people were into that.
What was the rationale for it?
I think Claire McKeegan was very much behind that too, as the executor. Mm-hmm. Oh, the idea is there's an opportunity. Oh, Duntoff, of course, was deep into that. Zora Arcus Duntoff. Zora is his first name, Z-O-R-A. His last name is a combination of two names, Arcus, A-R-K-U-S, hyphen, D-U-N-T-O-V.
Was that Russian?
Yes, right.
He
did a lot of racing in the old days with Cat Allards, and he drove, in fact, we've become great friends, and he's given me some pictures of him driving Bugattis in France, and I have a Type 35 Bugatti, so we have a lot in common to talk about. We race the Type 35 Bugatti at the vintage races, but it's club racing.
Sure.
Nothing.
Yeah, not
you can't get too serious. I mean, first of all, I'm too old and valuable, and so is a car.
Right.
You know, and any one of them could break at any second. So you don't want to be silly about this thing.
Well, do you think it's pretty much the conception of Zora Arcus Duntoff?
Oh,
Corvette,
I think that there was a lot more into that. A lot of people had to come to the party. But
somehow tapped to do with the original construction. I think it was an engineer, wasn't it?
Yes, engineer. Right. And eventually it started as a six-cylinder Blue Flame engine, which was from the 54, 53 area, and then with the advent of the new line of V8 engines, and the lightweight rocker construction, et cetera, and the high horsepower, it eventually found its way right into the Corvette, and then a new kind of performance Corvette was born, and that continued into the 60s with Bill Mitchell pushing the Stingray sort of design.
What were some of those exotic offshoots that he and Shinoda were involved with?
There were quite a lot of them. Chevrolet Engineering was also the driving force here. There was a Sebring Corvette, the SS, which basically started as some people said, trying to put the new V8 in a D Jaguar. But when Duntoff got a hold of that, he could make it a lot better. So that evolved into a whole new animal, and that gave the Corvette more image. They picked up the grill shape and a few other things. But then the Stingray was fostered by Mitchell. The whole line of cars and show cars that he had, and then he got into racing with them. He didn't race them, but he made sure that they all got visibility at Road America, and the right people drove them, and that sort of laid the groundwork for production vehicles. The image was there, and a certain amount of heritage. Yeah, this big gutsy V8. Could do something on a road circuit, and it was an emotional thing. So getting assigned to this kind of environment or this kind of studio was exciting, and it was an honor. You know, you'd almost, Mitchell had said a couple of times, says, damn it, kid, I'd pay to have a job like that. And I said, I'm paying.
What's your recollection of, did you ever ask anyone what the name was taken from? I believe there there was a very fast naval vessel.
Yes, yeah.
Was that the inspiration?
Right, right. I believe so.
The Canadians used them a lot.
Yeah, right. And of course, the Stingray image had been settled in the 60s. In fact, I was delighted because with that job, I got a company car. My first company car was a split-window Corvette Stingray. Now, coupe. Now, I could hardly afford to buy it, so I had to buy it without a radio. And I remember a couple of us doing the same thing. We went down to a local discount store and bought a portable radio to put in it. But it was exciting, and the car was really wonderful. And at that time also, we had to start thinking about how to do a four-passenger car. Now, the four-passenger car became the Camaro. It was competitive to the Mustang. And, of course, the Chevy 2 was there. Now, that was a car that was designed very quickly. It was very successful because it's such a basic vehicle. And we put that thing together in just a few months.
Right.
You know, the Chevy 2.
Chevy 2, I'm sorry.
When we decided, when the corporation decided to do a four-passenger sporty vehicle, the first Camaro, we had to use a cowl, rocker, and a lot of the components right off of that car, which is limiting. But again, the kind of crew that we had together were very sensitive to forms and how they should relate to the guy driving, giving him a feeling of sportiness. We did several, we did one Chevy 2 show car to lead up to that. I only say this because this is background for the Corvette image,
yes.
To try to get a feeling of a more aggressive nature, a feeling of relating to the driver, and putting some surface on the car that somebody might actually want to go out and put some polish on instead of having just a drag sort of plank to drive around.
A quick question. Who was responsible for the rear end placement of the engine in Corvair?
Oh, well, that was Ed Cole was a driving force behind that. And now, we handled the production end of that vehicle, but there was an advanced studio, and that was run by Ron Hill, who is now the head of industrial design at Art Center College of Design.
Right.
Now, he worked very closely with engineering, that Chevrolet engineering, that Ed Cole at that time, who was really after that air-cooled engine. Mm-hmm. That was the heart of it, and the placement of that, and he worked that out with the engineer became head of research, now retired. Anyway, so Ron did the basic layout of that. We productionized it,
mm-hmm.
But even there, we tried to get surface and line and shape that had less of the American Landiat flavor, but we purposely tucked in the fronts and the noses. At that time, it was popular to have cars look wide in the American market. And if you recall Camaros and the Corvairs and a Corvette, we purposely pulled the surfaces in so that they tapered in the rear. So the rear end didn't look really wide, but the wheels hung out. And the front end, we tucked that in, so it wasn't overstated like a big leering grin. It was more purposeful with the wheels hanging out again. And that was basically what we tried to do, give that kind of feeling to all those cars. So there's a direct relationship of the design direction between those cars. When we got into the next Camaro, the 60... a 70.5 Camaro, we even pulled that farther by tucking in the rear and having a smaller mouth.
Mm-hmm.
When we got into the latest Corvette, the next generation Corvette, we did an awful lot of that, pulled it in more and more.
How much influence did these Mitchell Shinoda, in some cases one-offs, I guess, the Mako Shard, remember, the Stingray became part of the line.
Yes.
Very venerable part of the line.
Right.
But the Mako Shark, and there were two or three others. Do you remember what they were?
Yeah.
Was he trying to experiment with how far you could go with the Corvette image and shape?
Yeah. I can best phrase it this way. Bill Mitchell was the chief designer.
Mm-hmm.
And Shinoda and I were the executors. Shinoda did the execution for the those show cars, the Stingray, and worked very closely with the advanced part of Chevrolet Engineering at that point. We were the executors for the production versions of those cars, you know, getting into the lift-off tops, making sure the bumpers worked, and all the production paraphernalia that you have to do. And what we had something to guide in on, Mitchell's design or his feeling of what the Corvette should be. Which is interesting too, because Mitchell did have distinct feelings about what cars should do. Now, some you may not agree with. The original Riviera was really beautiful. It's a classic.
What year is it?
Oh, it's 64, is it?
64.
Yeah, but later, you know, when getting into the boat-tailed Riviera, those he felt very strongly about that. To change the image into a more sporty vehicle and give it identity, however, it didn't last as good. But Bill was a guiding light on that. So you don't win them all, but at the same time, he generated a lot of revenue and sales. Because if the Riviera had stayed the same, it might have just fallen flat too. So getting into the Corvette, from a marketing merchandising point of view, he always tried to stay ahead of it and do the next generation. The Mako Shark, that he was chief designer of that, Larry executed that, and we executed a production version of it, which is detuned quite a bit next to the Mako. You know, that was evil. You couldn't sit in the thing, you know, just flat out race car. But he had a facility for setting a trend that you put into production. And that's what was so great about Bill. He had the foresight to leap out ahead and do this thing. It's very difficult. It's easy to talk about after it's done. But in a world where there was no Mako Shark, no Stingray, suddenly he made one. And out of that, he bred a whole car line.
You're saying that Bill Mitchell was the, if not, not the father of the Corvette, but the one who brought it along to its mature image today.
Yes, the body design. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the body design. Duntoff is very much, and Chevrolet Engineering, very much responsible for making those suckers go, you know. Duntoff is funny. He came down to the garage one day. We're working Saturdays and trying to do something. Duntoff came in with his cigarette and he says, "Henry, you want to see something new?" I said, "Sure, always want to see something." He says, "What do you have, Zora?" He says, "I have in the garage something you would like. Come with me." You know, almost Dracula, come with me. We went down to the garage, and here's a Corvette, and it's full of wires and instrumentation, everything else, and he says, "Come with me to test track." Next, between Chevrolet Engineering and the tech center proper, there's a long straightaway back and forth with loops on either end, so we hopped in the car and drove it out. He'd do this quite a bit. You never knew what he was doing or testing, but he had to get out and he had to live with the vehicles and get other opinions. So this was his way, you know. So took it out and he stopped in the middle of the track and just poured the coals on it. He went flat out through the gears. I don't know how fast. It must have been going about 140, something like that. And then he slams on the brakes. And I remember prying myself off the windshield, you know, the crevice where the top of the instrument panel fascia meets the windshield. I remember prying myself out. I said, "Zora, what in the hell are you doing?" He says, "I'm testing brakes." And that was it. Oh, he's something.
The image of the Corvette, of course, has been remarkable one, nurtured by Mitchell and yourself and others, and by Duntoff mechanically. It could have gone the way of the Thunderbird, which of course just sort of disappeared into a mass of nothing.
You know, and it could have gone that way, except for Bill having these Mako Shark Stingrays to continue that direction. It wasn't a marketing direction. it was an emotional direction and trying to keep that car pure in two-passenger form. There were four-passenger Corvettes put together. There's a Stingray version. In fact, a fiberglass model was built. And it looked exactly like the car, and you look at it again, and something's wrong with that. It's been hit. Something's... Because, of course, when you lengthen the passenger compartment, even if it's a 2 plus 2, you really destroy it. You take a beautiful woman and you put 30 pounds on her, and it isn't that same thing again. It's something
else. So there was some serious talk among marketing people for a four-door community, four-passenger four-door. Of course, the Thunderbird went that way and had an initial success, but then wiped out any sports car.
Right.
And so Bill wanted to keep it pure, I suspect.
Yeah.
And keep that Corvette in
Precious. Yeah, he did a very good job of that.
So to sort of wind up the Corvette in a sense, what was your input in terms of design for the later Corvettes?
Well, our big job, of course, the Stingray series was pretty well set in '63.
When you got there.
Yeah, so we got into the next generation Corvette, and what we're trying to do is establish a new image for it. The Stingray design basically had a horizontal line attitude that was pretty high. A lot of air would pass underneath the grill, and the accent, the peak line, was like a flying wing. Now what we're trying to do is upset that and get more contemporary by having the nose down really low and the rear end high and rake it and get everything down sucked tight. And this also came from Mitchell. He felt that the Corvette's direction should be two passengers only. And pull a body taut around those two passengers so there's no superfluous room, and pull the wheels out as far as possible to give the action of road holdingness, and then design the body so it again was sucked in tight to those components, the people and the wheels and the engine. And of course we wanted to give the car some rake, get it low to the ground and rear, and a little arrogant rear end with the rear end and the spoiler up there.
What was its appeal? Can you think back, maybe part of your own perception of owning one? What was the appeal of the Corvette?
It was special. It was it made very few compromises. It definitely was flamboyant. In that age, at that time, I remember the first time we saw one on a road. I was driving. In fact, I was driving to work, and one was coming the other way. And it was shocking to see, because we'd worked on it all that time, 3-4 years, and yet you'd never seen one out on a highway. And it had the ability to turn heads and say, hey, that's different. And it appealed that way. You know, people say, well, is it a ladies' car, is it a man's car? Well, hell, there aren't that many ladies' cars. Ladies like to drive in cars that turn men's heads. And that philosophy is basically Mitchell too. He never designed a pink little funny car for women. You know, there are some people who want that, but they're not the majority, especially now. You know, so the appeal was, here was an American sports car. The thing went like hell. It was relatively inexpensive for that time compared to something as fussy as a Jaguar. Ferraris are out of sight, Aston Martins are out of sight. Porsches are a little different, but they were expensive and they were fussy. And the rear suspension was strange on those that hop out of the way sometimes. But it was a true American sports car, and it was flamboyant. Right now you'd say, well, it's too flamboyant. In fact, we did some designs. You know how the fenders have a lot of blister height to them? And was accentuated for the design. We did one proposal that was so clean, it was smoother than today's Corvette Camaro. It was very slick with a split windshield with hatches. Bill's feeling was that it was too clean, too smooth for that time. It needed Bill Mitchell. That it was too clean, that it perhaps was, it was a good design, it was pure, but it might be too pure And if you're going to sell in that kind of volume over that period of time, he wanted more flamboyance.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a bit of flamboyance into this.
Yeah. What's grown up around it is a mystique. The Corvette owner figures he's a breed apart from other cars.
Mm-hmm.
While there are purists who disdain to they're this period, and they don't want to be associated with the later period or the earlier period, it goes on and on without any stopping.
Yeah, I think the people that don't like the car don't like fiberglass. They don't like.
I ask you, if I'm interpreting here, have you finished it? Whose idea that was?
Fiberglass?
Yeah.
I don't know where that started.
Was that
in Ford? It could have been, and I think it had to do with low tooling costs for low volume. I think there's some of that there.
Have you had problems over the years with replacing a dent in the fender?
No. In fact, in some cases, you bounce off and it's better. But I think there are people who would rather have a very, very pure shape out of aluminum that's hand-worked. You get better quality out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, fiberglass is a heavier medium.
Mm-hmm.
And custom paint, like on a Porsche, you just can't beat it, you know. And certain people don't like the idea of a production big bore V8.
Uh-huh.
That likes something that's more exotic. They lean towards the exotic. Well, the Corvette's whole issue here is that you get exotic car performance and looks, but you do it with everyday components, and that has a special appeal. Another word about the design on the later Corvettes. When you get into some of the classics, there's a proportion that comes on with a long hood, short deck, very low upper. You also, when you have a feeling when you look out over the hood, that your hood is straight out there, and you can see a lot of it, but your diamonds is the wheel, your front wheels out there. Your Bugattis, your Mercedes have that look. Bill's intent, and most of ours, is to reinterpret that in a contemporary vein, where you do see the wheels, but they're enclosed by aerodynamic blisters, and you drive the hood down into more of an aerodynamic profile. So there is that kind of heritage into it. Now, the purist will look at that and say, well, but, you know, that isn't a single envelope body. In order to do that single envelope body, you would get closer to a Ferrari Daytona shape or a Maserati Daytona shape. And I personally don't believe, I'd have to agree with Bill Mitchell here, that when you do 30 to 50,000, around 30 at that time, 30,000 units per year, you'll get pretty tired of what you have there. It won't be new enough. And it won't be as exciting as it was.
Was there any point in the early days of scrapping it, did anyone say, look, this is frivolous, we're only selling a few thousand units, so let's drop it?
No, there were times when sales are dropping a bit, and there were times when the dies had some problems with them because it made so many cars on them, so that there was a lot of hand finishing in the factory, and the decision had to be made whether to do the dies over again or come back in and metal finish a lot of it. But it's been a real solid vehicle, solid product line, and the club magazines and the enthusiasts. It's been a good vehicle for GM, especially Chevrolet.
Were there any production problems with the fiberglass in the early days? Have you heard any stories about that?
Well, I personally have had one, the 56 that I bought. In fact, 57. In fact, that was our wedding car. We got married here and we drove out west in it and all the way back. And I remember driving it about, I was sleeping in the car, Ellie was driving about 120. And I woke up because this giant thump. And I woke up and looked back over my head. It was a convertible, ragtop was flapping, you know, kind of noisy. It was this giant buzzard. It was in the middle of Texas. If it had been about a foot lower, it had been right through the car. But that vehicle, when I brought it back, I don't know if it was California Sun, it was black with a red interior, it looked great. But the paint checked all over it, and they repainted it. And it came right back. Something was in the resin or the mixture or something.
Right.
and I wholesaled it and got a 58.
Oh.
Which was absolutely gorgeous. Beautiful paintwork on it, so no problem.
So on the whole, if you were to sum up the whole, it would be hard to do, of course, but if you could sum up the history of the Corvette, how would you characterize it in a few well-chosen sentences? And its success, its future, and its current notoriety, its current shape, I understand many of the Corvette purists think this is a bastardization.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Well, there's some.
Yeah,
well,
there always will be some, I suppose.
I don't think it's widespread, but there are those who feel that they've gone too far. And what happened to our lovely Corvette of the 50s? I personally love it.
Yeah, I do too. So, well, I guess there are a couple things that have happened. The car has always been an image vehicle, and it's been guided. It's been guided up to this point by some people who had very strong convictions, and the most important of those, I believe, is Bill Mitchell. The car, during the time that it started, is a completely different vehicle than it is now. And it's, for me, and I'm prejudiced, it's gracefully. Yeah, for me, the car has very gracefully evolved from a make-do sports car into the next generation with its first V8 into a very, very basic sports car with power, and then on into the 427 category. It's a thundering dynamo, and then on again into the next generation, which we're proud of, developing into a vehicle that had independent rear suspension and alloy wheels, and getting better and better, right into, let me turn this one over. Right into the generation that's on the road now, that is a vehicle that will compete with almost any other sports car in the world outside of sheer top speed. But it's, as you can see by the present advertising and road tests, it's very well thought of by the press, especially as a value to the customer. It probably doesn't have, it lacks only one thing. It's that foreign snob appeal of Exotica. And I don't know if the Corvette had continued as it has, as a derivative of stock components off the shelf, if the Corvette could really live on today.
Was that the case you mentioned?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, the first Corvette was, how can you produce this kind of car in a factory and make it a two-passenger, that sort of thing, which is, six-cylinder engine. Yeah, right. Six-cylinder blue flame engine, and basically truck wheels, 15-inch wheels. That's about what you had to work with.
And how long did that condition prevail?
That was in 53 to 55, and then they put, in the old body, they put a V8 in it, the old body in 55. And then when a new body came in 56 and 57, then they had the V8s, the 283, 327, 350, and on up, 427.
When did it get its own chassis and its own components?
Oh, I think the 56, I think it was probably the Stingray area where the numbers got high enough where you got. It was an evolving thing where, where you can afford it, you kept building on it.
You probably didn't get separate status until it really became a sales were respectful.
Yeah.
Comments were
and people started recognizing in a corporation that there's good return on investment because there's relatively low tooling.
Right.
So it was a...
Well, would you sum it up? It's been a popular success. It's been...
Yes, absolutely. Unqualified success. I think it's one of the few durable image cars in the industry. When you look back at vehicles that were designed in 53, and how many of those are around in their present state as far as being a two-passenger, four-passenger, or sports right. car, or van, or whatever. This is a very durable product, and it's growing.
It's pretty unique in the industry.
Yeah.
Certainly the American.
One of the, I don't know if you're, Willie Brown, the state representative here, mm-hmm. Speaker of the House, is looking right now for a new Corvette. He's got an 85, but he wants to sell it, and he's just absolutely nuts about a Roadster, triple black, black interior, black top, and black outside, and he's an absolutely nut for a Corvette. He owns a portion of Ferrari, too, but you see the kind of garage and stable mates the Corvette now has.
Right.
Yeah, that's commendable.
It's quite an endorsement.
Yeah.
Engineering-wise, has it had a good history? Has it?
Yeah.
Have there been peaks and valleys, or just steady?
Oh, there have been peaks and valleys brought about by racing, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
The old days when they're racing out at out on a track, unless the guy knew how to drive it properly, you'd run out of brakes because it's heavy.
Yeah.
It's not a lightweight car.
So that would filter back to the factory.
And yeah. And also some drivers would be harder on brakes than others, just drive and slide it around, where if you planned ahead a little, you could go just as fast, you wouldn't thrash the machinery out.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to Jaguars as well, you know.
So but it's a special engineering team which kept tabs on the engineering improvements needed
right.
for the Corvette as it
right.
progressed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The Corvette was interesting too in this respect. From a design point of view, the bumper standards are difficult to deal with. Hidden mm-hmm. headlights, and there's a lack of real estate to really do everything you wanted to do. So as we developed the thing, got into urethane bumpers later. That was a godsend because you know the whole rear end panel can be urethane and it doesn't look like it's bumper.
How did that, the properties of urethane that made it so attractive and so durable?
Well, from a design point of view, it didn't look like a bumper. It looked like a true sports car without large car detailing. The bumpers were integrated into the body shape, so you had a single kind of body shape and instead of these ledges hanging off the car.
Right.
The problems that we ran into were color match and surface continuity. You had to watch that very carefully because you have to paint one kind of paint on urethane and another kind of paint on a body. They're two different color, two different paints, but you have to match them. And ultraviolet light can affect it. You can change the colors. And then, of course, if you assemble it improperly, since it's a soft material, it forgives, and it'll tend to pucker if you over-tighten something. So you got to watch that very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do it right and you design it to be assembled easily, it'll work. It works beautifully.
Did Corvette always have a separate assembly line?
Yeah, right. Now, I don't know in the beginning, I don't know where the first ones were built, but the Bowling Green thing is a Corvette plant now.
Has been for years.
Yes,
yeah,
right.
Strictly a Corvette.
You're right. Uh-huh.
But in terms of its engine, was Zora Duncas?
Yeah, Zora Duntoff.
Duntoff Arcus has even with the development of the Corvette engine over the years, pretty much.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know how much he was involved in the engine development per se and chassis.
Mm-hmm.
I think he probably had the engine developed for him and gave input into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Chassis, he was very close to all the time.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a chassis engineer, not an engine engineer.
Yeah. I think that. Now I may be wrong, but the way I associated with Zora. We were constantly working on a body chassis problems of uniting that,
mm-hmm.
and we'd get into some manifolding or some other details that might hurt the design, and we'd work that out.
Mm-hmm. Did the increasing size and power of the engine bother you, or were you think it was commensurate with its
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was needed. There were some powerful competition on tracks out there, and The Ford Cobra, of course, was a very big success story. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if Ford had done the Cobra in-house and what the Cobra might be today.
Yeah.
And it's kind of dropped out. It's become a very expensive collector's car. And
so sadly, they dropped those.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Now you have replicas out there, but that's about it. No.
Well, the racing image, of course, was very helpful, as it was for Ford, for the Cobras and the later Mustangs. Do you remember when you consciously got into racing? The company got into racing the Corvettes. And were you involved in any of that?
We were suppliers of design features or body design features.
Kits.
And we weren't sophisticated as far as aerodynamics. I remember working on 56, 57, 58 Corvettes, production versions where we took the windshields off and had low windscreens put on. Bill Mitchell had some cars prepared for Daytona Beach, some speed events, where he put bullet shapes on the front of the headlamps, which looked like Dagmars again, and some air scoops here and there for brake cooling. So we were mostly in the modifying business on these show cars for special vehicles. We did one all pearl white roadster with covered wheels, with a very low roll bar that was more of a show car, but it stimulated interest in Corvette.
Was the Corvette ever, it must have been an Indy pace car, at least a couple of them.
Yeah, it must have been, it was,
yeah.
And I don't remember all the years now.
I suppose for the younger generation, we should explain exactly what a Dagmar is.
Well, the Dagmar is a name that was pegged in the automobile industry, or by some of its detractors perhaps, for being a shape that was a large imitation of a woman's breast. That woman was Dagmar. She was a radio television personality.
Not television, no, personality.
In the late 50s.
Jerry Lewis show. Lewis. It was the forerunner of the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And she was a well-endowed young lady, much like Dolly Parton is today.
Yes,
she was the Dolly
right.
Parton of her.
That's right, right.
Yeah.
So,
but it's interesting that you mentioned that was also a derogatory term, that perhaps those who didn't like the age of excess in those days, thought it was a vulgar copying on the,
right.
the various
It was overdone.
Yeah.
It wasn't needed. It wasn't functional.
Right, that's right. Well, the Corvette has been a marvelous success story, and you certainly have had a part in it, especially in the later years, which I'm sure you're proud of.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There are probably 100 stories that I could go on with David, but I guess they need triggers to remember.
Yeah.
And some of them were very serious at the time. You look back at them, some of these trials and tribulations of putting a car on the road.
It
makes you lay awake nights, but it's funny now. They're funny.
Remember one or two design crises that you had in the Corvette history? When someone said, hey, we're going to really radically redo this, and should we or should we not?
Oh, we had not radical. I think that we had a lot of spirit going with that vehicle, and we kind of evolved it, and the engineers that we had working on it really were together on it. We had it's a vehicle that's got a defined course, and the image is there, and you know kind of where it's going. There's a lot of vehicles out on the road who are a lot of vehicles that are confusing in their direction.
This was an evolutionary.
Yes.
That never wavered.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent.
When did you come up with the ideas, presumably they're concurrent with their current methodology, when did you come up with the idea of having, did you say four-wheel brakes? Or independent suspension?
Independent rear suspension. The engineering group had to have that because improved braking and improved suspension just has to happen on a race course. And the people that are buying these kinds of sports cars are buying the tradition behind it also. And if you ignore some of these features, you just don't sell cars to that audience. Certainly there have been a lot of people who probably would have rather have had Ferraris or Jaguars at that time, but for value received, it'd be much better to buy a Corvette.
What was the other innovation you mentioned earlier? The rear suspension and what else were there? Four-wheel brakes or disc brakes?
Yeah, disc brakes, of course. I forgot what I mentioned before.
One last question, then we'll leave the Corvette for the moment. Who's responsible for the current design? It's quite striking.
Jerry Palmer.
Palmer?
Yeah.
Quite a departure. Really.
Oh, yeah, it really is.
And has it been universally acclaimed?
Oh, yeah, I think it has. Yeah, in fact, it's dated, the Corvette that we worked on, because that is almost too flamboyant.
Mm-hmm.
And the car was right for its time then, and now it's right for its time now, which delights me. Right. Right.
Has a vaguely European...
Yes, it does. Right. It's still a Corvette. It has the characteristics of Corvette, mm-hmm. but it's much more aerodynamic now,
yes.
aerodynamic looking, and more universal design, Euro-American design.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a lovely product. It's well proud of your partner.
Thank you.
Well, let me get out of the way, and why don't you take us through the next stage of your career. You put a Jeep designer for Chevrolet too in 1963. That was quite an honor.
And eventually, of course, that studio became Chevrolet 3,
mm-hmm.
and that's the time when the A-bodies and other cars were designed in Chevy too, but we kept the sports car group, so I really had the best years of design business back at Design Staff. In fact, I had that studio for 10 years,
really?
63 to 74, mm-hmm. and then one day...
Well, I don't go that fast. You don't want to gloss over 10 years, but quickly, what sort of impressions, or what sort of major satisfactions, what models gave you, you had the most fun with in those 10 years?
Well, obviously the 68 Corvette, new Corvette body was, we really felt good about that. The second one was a 70 and a half Camaro, because we were able to break ground with that and give it its own image. As I said earlier, it didn't hinge on the construction of a Chevy too.
Could we stop right there and maybe could you give us a sort of a capsule history of the Camaro? Certainly a fantastic vehicle and mm-hmm. still incredibly popular. Remember its origins?
What year was it? That was 1967. Camaro came out. Harley Earl where was Harley Earl? We did a Chevy 2 show car for 1966 or thereabouts, someplace in there, I forget what. And we put it in a New York Auto Show. And it was our expression to take a Chevy 2, which is basically a bread and butter car.
Mm-hmm.
There's a need at that time for that kind of vehicle. The Falcon, the Ford Falcon was out there, and people were into getting smaller, less expensive vehicles. But
you'd come up with a stopgap in the Monza.
Well, that was a Corvair, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But the Chevy 2 was a front-engined, conventional vehicle,
right.
And it was pretty squarish looking. But what we did one day is, with some sketches and some agreement from our management, we took a car and we customized it. We cut the roof down and we rounded it and we did a lot of things to it, took the bumpers off and made it much more aggressive and put it in a show. Well, it was clearly a four-passenger vehicle, sort of in the where the Mustang was going, that sort of thing. So suddenly in the marketplace, with the success of the Mustang, we found that there was a real niche for a four-passenger sports car. We already had the Corvette,
right.
But we had the other end, the Chevy 2,
right.
And then we had the Corvair.
Mm-hmm.
but we still didn't have that very simple, easy to understand, yet exciting four passenger car. And that's how the Camaro got born, if you will. And that was a unique design job because there were certain critical hold elements that disturbed the designer. In those days, if you had a long dash to axle, in other words, from the front door cut to the front wheel, if you had a greater distance there, it implied a lot of engine power. When you sprung from the Chevy 2 chassis, that dimension was very short because it had a small engine in it, and yet we had to use that architecture for this first Camaro. So what we did, we extended some sheet metal ahead of the wheel to give the look of a decent amount of hood relative to tail, and then we shortened up the tail quite a bit. So we got the proportion we needed. However, the wheelbase, or the front wheel, we would have liked it to have been moved forward a little, and we would have liked to have dropped the cowl to get the hood a little lower, so we got a better proportion. As it was, we designed it or styled it to offset all those negatives. And as we look back at them now, they don't look too bad. They don't really look like they sprang, like they're derivative of a Chevy 2. When we got the chance to do the all-new 70.5 Camaro, we could throw all those rules away, and we identified to the engineers those areas that we felt needed attention. One of the chief engineers at that time was Alex Mayer, who has since retired, M-A-I-R. Mayer became head of Chevrolet, and he just recently, upon retirement, was group vice president in charge of the tech center. In other words, research labs, Bob Frosch, F-R-O-S-C-H, who used to be with NASA, and Bob Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, who ran advanced engineering, and Herb Rubicki, who runs design staff, all report now, or did report until last month, to Al Mayer. So, and Mayer has always had a facility for recognizing and listening to people as they try to put product together. And he was one of our champions to try to get this car better than any other car that we'd done. We had some areas that were not as successful, I think. We tried very hard to increase the height of the deck on a Camaro. And at that particular time, I remember Pete Estes was against it, and Bill Mitchell was against it.
Because Pete Estes at that time was?
He was head of Chevrolet.
General manager
of Chevrolet. Now, at that time, it probably was the right decision. In fact, the car still looks good, even with this very tiny rear end. So that's a relative thing. I don't think you can say the design is any worse or better. I just pointed out that we all thought a little different about how the product should be.
Well, that must be an exciting time for you.
Oh, that was very exciting. I can't tell you how people would work overtime and do new, to just extend themselves to all ends to make this thing work.
Was there any negative feeling from anyone that would say, hey, you got the Corvette, what do you want another, why are you heading in another sports car direction?
I don't recall. They serve two different markets. One is a four-passenger, one's a two-passenger, and the performance was quite a bit different. Road handling was different. The Camaro never did have independent rear suspension, so it had a certain amount of limitation to it.
Yeah.
And there's cost considerations, too.
You were attempting to hit the market, the family sports car market.
That's right.
Sense, for people who wanted to have a family involved in a modified sports car.
Right.
That succeeded really beyond your wildest.
Oh yeah, really, it hung on. Even to the point of wonderment how people could accept a name like Camaro. Because Pete Estes decided one day he'd been bombarded with all these names, and he said, damn it, he says, I'm going in the closet and I'm gonna come out with a name, and that's the way it's gonna be. You know, because they had surveys and everything else.
Yeah.
He came out with this this is it, the name is Camaro. And he was greeted with a wall of silence. And after a few minutes, somebody had the guts to ask him, what the hell does it mean? And supposedly it means friend
in
Spanish.
I see.
But there's another thing that it says that it means something a lot worse than that, like shrimp and something worse in Spanish. So yeah. So but the name caught on.
It did.
And the power of advertising and product, good product, and it's weathered very well.
So. I remember you well remember too. It may well have been a deliberate ploy by the marketing and publicity department that the James Garner's television series, so immensely popular for about 5 years, mm-hmm. wrote that fantastic.
Yeah, Rockford, wasn't it?
The Rockford Farm.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
And what was the Camaro that he drove in that series?
That was a 70 and a half.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And apparently some astute publicity guy said, "Hey, let's get this into
sure.
But it's going to be a popular series." Oh my gosh, the exposure must have been incredibly valuable. Because he was always putting them through its paces. Somebody was. I always think that Jim was actually driving. Mm-hmm. Sequence, I'm not sure he was.
I doubt. Well, he's a proficient race car driver, though. But
yeah.
Some of those are high risk scenes, and his
right.
body's worth it. I mean, it is worth not crashing.
Right. So the Corvette and the Camaro have been two of the things that associated with your career that you're probably the most exciting. What about the bread and butter cars? Really, the lifeblood of the industry. What sticks out there?
Okay, they were mostly designed in the Chevy 1 studio and the other studios, although the Chevy 2 and a Corvair were. So our assignment was mostly the image vehicles.
What else were there besides those two?
That I worked on?
Yeah, in image vehicles.
Oh, production image vehicles, basically those two and some of the show cars. That we worked on.
Can you talk about some of the
Once we got into what we hoped would be the next generation of, I should do this too. Later, we were working on the next generation of what the Corvette might be,
mm-hmm.
and Duntoff and people in the corporation were working on rotary engines, and we had a four rotor Corvette. That we felt is the only way to go. It was great. Also, there was a two-rotor Corvette design that was put together at Pininfarina. And we completed ours, they completed theirs, we had a show, and as it turned out, the rotary engine went its way in GM, and neither car was actually built. The four-rotor was extremely interesting. It was, again, Bill Mitchell did lay some direction there. He felt that that particular vehicle ought to have a European, almost Teutonic German streamliner look.
Mm-hmm.
And to him that meant that it was teardrop front, teardrop rear.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely difficult to pull off because it's a rather short car.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, Jerry Palmer was my assistant at that time. We worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through tape drawings and everything else, and there was a frustration on Mitchell's part. I remember him leaving the studio very angry because we couldn't get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember at that particular point, I had to go to the board and do a tape drawing of the side view and change the direction, so we did in fact get that.
Mm-hmm.
At that point we said, we've got to walk away from aero and put our image hat on,
mm-hmm.
and see what we can do with this vehicle. Now, as it turned out, I considered one of our most successful designs because the thing is really sleek, it had hatches. Duntoff did a magnificent job in the chassis department. Eventually, it wound up with a big honking V8 in it, and it went like hell.
Which one was
this? This is the Aerovette. They call it the Aerovette, and it's a four-rotor Corvette show car.
In the year?
We completed it in 1973 for the Paris Auto Show. And Duntoff and I took my wife along, were sent over with the car. The car went to a little garage on a side street. in a commercial district in Paris to be prepped. GM overseas had rented this thing. And I remember getting off the plane and the food hadn't gone too well with me, and I asked for some directions on the facilities, and I walked in the back and he pointed me, and there was a hole in the ground with two cast footprints, and that was it. You know? And there weren't many tools around either. So anyway, we got the car working. Delco was there with some instrumentation, and we put it on a Paris show stand, and it was a very successful show.
A lot of
time. Yeah, a lot of good things. At that time also, that was in 73, I had been asked if I would like to accept the position of director of design at Opel in Germany for European passenger car design. And my wife and I went to Germany from Paris checked that out too.
Oh, okay. You were there at the time. So they offered to you while you were in Paris.
That's right. No, before that, but when I went over to follow the car, please go down to Frankfurt and Rüsselsheim and check that out. Rüsselsheim.
One last question about the Corvette. The show Corvette in Paris, were any of those designed, if it did include design innovations, were any of them mechanical or engineering or innovations, were they incorporated later? Are we talking about tomorrow?
No,
yeah,
Corvette.
Were they later incorporated into later Corvettes?
There may have been some things, but the whole chassis layout was completely different because this is a mid-engined, like a Boxer, Testarossa, or Countach, Lamborghini
setup. You got to a mid-engine the mindset.
No, and it was money, and it was tooling, and transfer case for transmission and rear end. But the car was really slick. It still is. It exists someplace.
Is it still?
Yeah, you're right.
So it was really the best of its word, an idea car.
Right, really right. There were good indications that we could have gotten it into production at the next time for retooling after the 68. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the one that's on the road now. But here again, when you look back, the car on the road is extremely successful, and there's probably less tooling invested in it. And a direction like that might be the next generation. We might have been a generation ahead of it.
Right.
The two-rotor Corvette that Pininfarina did was judged to be a very nice car, well-executed.
Yes.